and I look up and I see Villarreal is blocking the plate, and the ball is going to get there before I do. So I got one choice, and one choice only. That's to cream him and knock the ball loose. I've got four seasons of frustration going down that baseline with me, and not only is this a run, it's my chance. I'm going to take his fucking head off. I'm going to explode him like that ball exploded the albatross. I'm going to leave broken bits of can't-shut-the-fuck-up Dominican cocksucker scattered over the infield. So when I'm a good 5 feet from him, I make my move. I go like I'm going for the Olympic gold in the pole vault, which led to what was to be known as the Superman slide. Yes, he was a fat fuck, and he ran like he had tubs of lead tied to his cleats, but he was quick. So, as I leave my feet, Villarreal has the good instinct to duck, and I sail, vertical, over him, not even grazing him, past the ump. On the replay, you can see him saying, "What the fuck?" even through his mask, and I land a good 3 feet on the far side of home plate, having never touched it. Villarreal spins and tags me out, while I'm still wondering what happened. When you kill a goddamn albatross with your first big league at bat, you think, yeah, that's going to be the highlight they play when I do something good. They're going to go, oh, nice turnaround by Nelson, but let's take a look at that time he killed the rare seabird. But no. You show the world that you have the athletic prowess to not be able to run into a fat Dominican when there's a fucking line painted up to him, that piece of film is going to Cooperstown. And ne'er a day shall pass from now to the end of time when your name is mentioned that with it is not shown your dumb ass flying through the air to land with your dick in the dirt to be tagged out as gentle as Jesus picking a baby to be born. Doesn't get any worse, right? Can't, right? 19 times a season, regular season, 25 times if you count spring training games. I got to the point where a week before we played the Dodgers, I'd start losing my shit, making dumb mistakes in the field. I get some beta blockers from my doc to slow my heart down when we're playing LA, so I can hit, but I can't field for shit on them either. So they bring up a kid from the minors who takes my place as a starter. I become the utility guy, playing when someone is hurt, or bats from the wrong side, pinch hitting, unless it's against the Dodgers, because believe me, I'm not the only one who notices I'm cursed. As bad as it can get, right? If I'm a pitcher and I let a guy get into my head this bad, I'm selling Chevys in Petaluma, because fuck knows I can't go into broadcasting and have the Superman clip play every goddamn day. And the front office isn't going to hire the dead bird slash cocksucker guy to coach or scout, right? So I still have a job, year-to-year contract, minimum money, which isn't bad, except now I have a kid and a wife who wants to hang with the wives whose husbands are making major coin, and she spends and dresses like them, too. Could be worse, though, right? Then the Giants' starting catcher decides to shoot his coke dealer in the off-season in a Miami disco, at the same time that Villarreal's contract is up at the Dodgers. So that babbling fucking ball of chorizo becomes our starter. So it's every day, every goddamn day, I go into the clubhouse. How you doing, skipper? How's your wife? Your kid getting big, huh? How's your mom? Guy has been in the States 10 years now, and he still only got about 40 words of English, which he rearranges 100 times a day to get up my ass. She's dead, Chava. Just like she was this morning. Just like she will be in 20 fucking minutes when you ask me again, Chava. She's dead! She wasn't dead. My mother is still alive and lives in Jupiter, Florida, with 7 miniature poodles. But that's not the point. The guy was annoying. He says, "Oh, I'm sorry, man. Anything I can do? Man, that must be so hard. I lose my mother? I don't know what to do. My heart goes out to you, man. How's your wife holding up?" So that's when I decided to kill the cocksucker. But not right away, because now that he's not playing for the Dodgers anymore, my batting average is going up, and I don't want to jinx it. So instead, I compromise and decide to get him kicked out of the game and ruin his life in the interim. This is a time in baseball when steroids have become a pretty big deal. On our team, you got Barry Bonds, who's hitting home runs like a mortar barrage, and whose head has grown to a size where when they make his promotional bobblehead, they just do the whole thing to scale. While across the bay in Oakland, Mark McGuire now has forearms like Popeye and will only speak in dialects of horse. And they're keeping Jose Canseco chained to a post under the ballpark and throwing him raw meat until right before game time. So the league is starting to get sensitive about it. Personally, I stay away from the juice, as I already have what my wife calls anger issues, and steroids are supposed to be bad for that. But the league is starting to spot check players, so I figure this might be my chance to get rid of Villarreal without jinxing my hitting. By this time, my wife was breeding Yorkshire Terriers, so naturally, I'm nearly able to claim her vet as a dependent on my taxes. So in exchange for a stack of prime tickets behind home plate, the vet hooks me up with some animal steroids in powder form, which are supposed to be tasteless, except for a slight hint of dog balls, which I figure Villarreal will never notice, because he constantly eats jerk chicken and Caribbean pulled pork, which, for all I can tell, are spiced with garlic, fire, and dog balls anyway. So I start slipping a spoonful of powdered dog balls in Villarreal's Gatorade in the clubhouse, and after a week or so, when I figure it is built up in his system enough to be detected in a piss test, but before he starts barking and humping an ump's leg, I have my wife call the anonymous tip line to rat him out. Now, it's a hard sell with the league to convince them a guy is on performance-enhancing drugs when he's so slow that when he hits a double, fans can go take a leak and still get back to their seats to see him slide. But my wife, it turns out, is a terrific liar. So I'm thinking that Villarreal is going to be peeing in the 100-game suspension cup any day. But the day before the spot test, the son of a bitch whiffs on a backdoor slider, winding himself into a knot and snapping the haymate bone in his right hand, which gets him put on the disabled list for 3 weeks while he has the bone removed. Turns out the haymate bone is one of those things like the appendix, the tonsils, and algebra that you don't really need but is left over from a time when we used to live in trees and didn't have calculators. But with Villarreal out of the clubhouse for a month, my batting average jumps up 25, my blood pressure drops 20 points, and I'm starting to make some good plays on defense. At this point, when my guard is down, my wife decides that we need to buy a house in Marin with a bigger yard for her dogs, and I'm in such a good mood, I give in. And before you know it, I'm commuting to the ballpark across the Golden Gate Bridge every day. A week before he can actually start playing, Villarreal comes back from Arizona, where he was doing rehab on his hand, and he's in the clubhouse all day, every day.
How you doing? You getting some good at-bats, man? How's your wife? She like the new house?
6,000 times a day, and my batting and fielding go to shit again, and I'm afraid I'm going to get sent down to the minors unless Villarreal shuts the fuck up. But how? So my wife is on me about the new house. How there are all these plants in the backyard that aren't safe for her precious puppies, and maybe even the kid, and she wants them out of there. Foxgloves, she calls them. Really tall flowers. I look at the Yorkies, which are about a foot tall at best, and the foxglove, the poison part of their flowers, which are about 4 feet off the ground, and I tell her I'll get to it next time we have a day off. Digitalis, she says. It's in the flowers. If one of them eats one of those flowers, their little heart will explode, and we won't even know what it was from. What? I say. I say, what? Digitalis. They make heart medication from it. If you have a weak heart, before she finishes her sentence, I decide it's time to do some yard work, because goddammit, those little dogs give her a lot of joy, and you can't have one of their little hearts explode from eating those horrible flowers. So I cut those sons of bitches down, pile them up until I have a whole bale of them, then put them in the garage workshop where the puppies can't get to them, and so they can dry, and I can get rid of them responsibly. So, next day off at home, the team has, I strip all the dried flowers off the stems and crunch them up in a coffee grinder, until I have about a baby food jar full of fine powder. I mean really fine. Like, you pinch it between your fingers, and it just sticks in that shape. Of course I don't taste it, but it doesn't have very much odor at all, and I can't wait to get to the clubhouse next game day and get ready for the team meal. I mean, I am excited. I cram as much of the powder into the jar as I can, and I'm off to the ballpark. But as I'm driving down the hill, out of Sausalito, and onto the bridge, I'm almost too excited. I mean, I'm sort of out of breath, and I'm sweating like crazy. Then my vision gets kind of blurry, like vibrating blurry, and I lose sight of the road for a second. I drifted out of my lane a little, I guess. It turns out that there was a semi-truck coming the other way that stopped me from really hurting anyone else. Although don't let them fool you. No matter what they say about how safe Mercedes are, they cannot withstand a head-on with an 18-wheeler at 50 miles per hour. Guy driving the truck was fine. Yeah, it turns out that digitalis can be absorbed through the skin. So I probably should have worn gloves when I was preparing my powder. Who knew? Villarreal batted 335 that year, and you can bet your ass he didn't shut up the entire time. I'm just glad I wasn't there for my funeral, because I know he probably talked until half the people there wanted to join me in the casket just for some peace and quiet. So, like I said, I'm cursed. You think it was the bird or the murder plot? I don't know, said Mike. Do you believe in karma? Because if karma is a thing, I'm thinking it's the murder plot. That sounds reasonable, said Mike. But why are you telling me about it? You don't know? That's why I asked. Well, because I'm stuck. I'm not moving on. This isn't how it's supposed to be. Mind you, I don't know how it's supposed to be, but this isn't it. Stuck on a bridge forever with a bunch of other loopy spirits? I thought you were the one that was supposed to move things along. And telling me about an annoying catcher is supposed to help that? How? It's supposed to make you realize it, I suppose, said the ballplayer. It's like stealing second base. The manager can tell you to go. The first base coach can signal you to go. The batter can know you're going to go. But you have to watch the pitcher, watch the catcher, watch the first baseman. You have to see all the signs. Then you know it's right to steal. I'm just one of the signs. But you have to make the move to steal. That's the least helpful sports analogy I've ever heard. Well, you're not the one who needs help, are you? Chapter 22. Fresh. Bird played Summertime on the speakers. Minty Fresh stepped out of the back room of his store when he heard the bell over the door jingle and saw a man in a yellow suit and Homburg hat coming down the aisle. Minty caught himself against the counter. The man in yellow pulled up, almost losing his balance, but for sure losing his cool with the misstep. The man in yellow had no more expected to see Minty Fresh than Minty expected to see him. He turned his surprise into a fingertip to the brim of his hat salute. Minty, he said. Lemon, said Minty Fresh, all of a sudden feeling his shit tightening down. I didn't expect to find you all here.
I expect not, said Minty.
I had some business with Evan.
Yeah, he don't work here anymore.
Lemon looked to the back of the store, where a 40-ish African-American man in a nice suit was browsing the jazz vinyl.
I don't suppose y'all got them soul vessels here, do you?
No, cuz, I do not. Those motherfuckers are not here.
The man in the suit, he wore a caduceus pin on his lapel. A doctor came to the counter with a first pressing of Miles Davis' Birth of Cool. He set it on the counter, and as the mint one rang it up on his old-style mechanical register, the doctor looked from Minty to Lemon to Minty, then back to Lemon. From the 7-foot shaved-head man wearing a mint-green shirt and chocolate dress slacks in light wool to the linebacker-sized gent dressed head-to-toe in yellow, even down to his yellow python skin shoes.
Are you two for real? He asked.
Pardon? Said Lemon.
You two, you look like you walked out of a 70s blaxploitation film. You know, when you reinforce the stereotype like that, you make it harder on all the younger brothers coming up, right? Difficult enough for a young man to make his way without every old white lady in town terrified she just spotted Superfly down on Market Street. Forget about a black woman trying to be taken seriously.
He laid down his cash and took his change and the record.
I have a hard enough time getting my son not to talk like a thug as it is, and having you two dinosaurs riding in on the soul train from the Cretaceous is not helpful. You are grown-ass men. Act like it. Do you feel me?
Lemon and Minty both nodded slowly, remembering doing that same contrite, synchronized nod when they were boys. The doctor shot his lapels, tucked his record under his arm, and strode out of the store. Lemon glared at the door, then turned back to Minty.
Hush.
70s? Motherfucker, I had these shoes made last year, said Minty, his voice two indignant octaves higher, looking down at his Italian patent leather loafers in mint green, as smooth and shiny as pillow mints.
Excuse me for perpetuating your stereotype, said Lemon, but we got some archetypical shit to do up in here, and we need to dress the part.
You don't never be lying, said Minty, using the phrase for the first time in 25 years. You don't never be lying.
But he do have a point, said Lemon.
Yeah, you do be a bit ostentatious, said Minty.
Me, said Lemon, pointing to himself, touching his diamond tie tack in the process as if pushing an irony button. Me? You ever look at yourself, nigger? 9 feet tall, motherfucker, weigh 32 pounds. Shit. You be ostentatious, standing in the weeds wearing camouflage.
Style can't be denied, Lemon. That's the difference between you and me. You a slave to fashion, and I'm a sultan of style.
Lemon laughed, started to talk, then laughed some more, pointing at Minty to hold the moment until he got his breath. When he did, he shrugged grandly, raised his arms as if appealing to the Holy Spirit, and said,
"Since when was this fashionable?"
"About the time that piece of trash Buick was new," said Minty, grinning.
"Know what? Fuck that nigger. He don't know us when we didn't have but a single pair of raggedy-ass trousers each. Am I right?"
"You know you are,"
Minty, in the groove now of how they talk to each other.
"How your mama?"
"Still dead."
"So sad. That woman a saint, what she put up with. I learned some shit over the years. Counseling. Your daddy was emotionally unavailable, you know that?"
"That's right."
"And my daddy treated women like they was throwaway things. You know that fucked up my shit."
"You a broke dick dog, Lemon Fresh."
"You know I ain't at all what I used to be."
"I was picking up on that. New hat, right?"
Lemon laughed again, wheezing a little bit.
"You funny. Hey, you still got that book I sent you?"
"No, I passed it on, like you do."
"You did all right, though."
Minty looked around the shop, at his handmade Italian shoes, back at Lemon.
"I could have used some coaching."
"Do you know how it is? We was young and stupid."
"We?"
"But we ain't now."
"No, we ain't."
"In fact, I'm not even who I am no more, you know, except for my good looks and charm and whatnot."
"That right.
My shit is informed by a 1,000-year-old super-enlightened being from the underworld up in here."
Lemon thumped his lapel with an open hand.
"Super-enlightened, huh?"
Minty looking baffled.
"What you saying?"
"Super-enlightened, and he still let you drive that ugly-ass dog bit old Buick?"
"You saw that, did you? I was gonna get that shit pounded out.
Looked like something happened when you was running. You always was afraid of dogs. Walk a quarter mile, not to go by that white dog Miss McCutcheon had fenced up in her yard. Was you running from them doggies, Lemon?"
"That white dog come over that fence once. You wasn't there. I spent best of an afternoon top of Oldsmobile before Miss McCutcheon come get him. I hated that dog."
"You was running," Minty smiled. "Saws I need to know."
"You think you smart. I know you, Minty Fresh. I watch your mama whip your ass for having pee pants when you was 5. But you don't know me. This ain't gonna be like it was before. I ain't like Orcus."
"Who?"
Minty tisking like, what you wasting my time with now?
Orcus, big black motherfucker with wings, tall shit out of this town. Kill him a bunch of y'all motherfuckers. You know who I mean.
Oh! Minty searched his memory. Oh, yeah! Whatever happened to him?
He knew what happened to Orcus. He'd been torn apart by the Morrigan.
Not the point, said Lemon. I ain't like him, all busting shit up, biting people's heads off and shit. I'm moving in smooth, in the daylight.
He held out his arms, just letting sunlight through the front windows get all over him.
Shit about to get real up in here, Minty.
It feels like it is.
But nobody don't get between me and what I want got a worry in the world.
That's good to know.
Not even that pale white girl of yours.
Mmp,
Minty said, a percussive sound, like disappointment hitting home. He shook his head slowly, looking at the counter, just wishing, regretting, truly unhappy that Lemon had gone there. And when he looked up, when his head snapped up, his eyes were like golden fire.
You ain't bad, Lemon.
Lemon's eyes went wide for a second. Then he tightened down, tried to show some swagger.
You don't know me. You ain't just talking to me anymore, cuz.
You ain't shit, Lemon.
You don't know what I am now, Minty. I've been 50 years in a cave. I have outweighed mountains. I have slain multitudes. I brought dark death down on whole cities. Do not fuck with me.
Uh-huh, said Minty, unimpressed. Of all of us. All of us that collect souls, pass them on, do the business of death. You, all of a sudden, chosen by this badass Lord of Darkness to lead his conquest over light? You, Lemon Fresh? You? Why you? What make you special? Your blood? Is it your golden eyes?
Minty leaned on the counter, leaned forward, eyes wide, so Lemon could get his point.
Is that it, motherfucker? You the only one in the whole world picked to start a new order? The only upstart from the underworld to rise in my motherfucking city? You? Bitch-ass, lemon, motherfucking, broke-ass, Buick Fresh? Nigga, please!
You need to chillax, cuz.
Lemon was suddenly interested in the rack of CDs near him.
You got any Xanax or gin or something back there you can self-medicate with? 'Cause that anger is not healthy. Our people's got high blood pressure. They have veins standing out on your head right here.
He took off his hat and pointed to a spot on his own head.
Right here, like throbbing and shit. You probably having a stroke.
Minty said, you touch any of my people. What happened to Orcus will look like a spa day compared to what happened to you. Now get the fuck out my store.
Lemon looked up from the CDs.
Don't push me, nigga. I will end you right here.
Minty now held his arms out to his sides, angry, Jesus style.
Suffer all the bitch-ass motherfuckers need an ass-whooping unto me, for I shall rain wrath down upon them.
That look. Lemon took a step toward the counter, then saw something there in Minty's stare that stopped him. He checked his watch, which was thin and gold and looked feminine, on a man his size.
You lucky I got appointments and shit.
He turned on his heel and strolled away, limping a little from his burden of unshakable chill. The bell over the door jingled, and he was gone.
You a lying motherfucker, Minty said.
He went to the back room, found a bottle of cognac he kept in the desk, uncorked it, then paused, corked it, put it away. He didn't need to steady his nerves. He went back out front, flipped and cued the album on the turntable, then sat on a high-back stool he kept behind the counter, stretched his legs out, threw his head back, closed his eyes, and let Bird's notes wash over him. He didn't know what he would have done if Lemon had come at him. If whatever Lemon was now, or what deity was wearing Lemon had come at him. He didn't have a plan, didn't have a clue, but he was steady, cool as a sea breeze, unafraid, because there was something, even if he didn't know exactly what it was. Even as he'd asked Lemon,
What makes you special?
He had felt it.
You ain't the only one, Lemon.
Lily said, Has it ever occurred to you that this death merchant thing is just a shitty job?
A dirty job, Charlie said.
The big book says it's a dirty job.
But yeah, I used to think that we were like death's middle management. But we're not. We're death's grunts.
They were sitting at the bar in Charlie's empty shop, there to plan what they were going to do with it.
Whatever you are, it's ridiculous. There's no vacation time, no retirement, and if you fuck up, the universe as we know it will collapse. Plus, the system is insanely complex, and you know what chaos theory says about that.
Sure, said Charlie, but go ahead and say, so I'll know that you know, though.
Chaos theory more or less says that in any complex dynamic system, it's impossible to predict behavior because even the tiniest variable can have a huge effect down the line. Throw everything into chaos.
Right, Charlie said. But Audrey doesn't think that chaos is necessarily bad.
It sounds kind of bad to me.
That's because you're thinking of chaos as disorder. But they're not the same thing. And she's a Buddhist. And they're all about just making sure you're paying attention or something. Remember what she said about the universe seeking order, balance, and the wobbles when it can't find it? Well, chaos is the condition between order and disorder, the transition between one system and another. So that's what's going on.
Well, good, Charlie said. I should check on Sophie. I left her playing upstairs.
You have no idea what I'm talking about, do you?
Yes, it's just that when I try to apply it,
no.
How do you know this stuff? Isn't chaos theory math or something? I thought you went to culinary school.
That's where I learned it. First day, right after you learn to wash your hands and sharpen a knife. You have to know chaos theory to make basic biscuits.
Really? For biscuits?
I never gave my mom credit.
Really?
No, not really, Asher. Did your brain stay tiny and reptilian when Audrey changed you into a real boy? I'm trying to tell you, I don't think we should reopen your store. I don't think you're going to need it, because there's a new system happening. I'm trying to tell you, I don't want to work in retail, for you or for Rivera. I have a thing now. I'm beyond working in retail.
The crisis line, I understand.
No, not the crisis line. Yes, the crisis line, but there's something else. Look, I've always had an empty place in my life that I've alternatively tried to fill with food and penises. But now I have something.
Mike, the guy who used to be you,
that guy you look like,
he's calling me.
He's calling me from the bridge, from beyond the grave. Just me. Only me.
Wow, Charlie said. Like now? Since, I mean, after he's dead?
Yesterday, Lily said, from one of the hardwired lines on the Golden Gate.
Wow, Charlie said.
Yeah, Lily said.
How's he doing?
Kinda hard to say. He sounds happy, but a little freaked out that he'll be accused of boning a nun.
Hey, that's consensual, and she's not really a nun anymore.
He hung his head.
I miss her.
And it's been how long since you've seen her?
Yesterday.
Oh, for fuck's sake, Asher. One day? Em and I broke up months ago, and still, when I think about him as I'm going to sleep, my heart sounds like someone falling down the stairs.
One day?
But I just got her back, sort of.
One day?
Mike told me the ghost on the bridge has been waiting for her lover for 200 years. And there's thousands of others waiting. Who knows how long?
Blow me one day, Asher.
Wait, thousands?
What?
Yeah, he said there are thousands of ghosts on the bridge.
Charlie swiveled on his stool, looked at her head on. Up until then, they'd been more or less talking at a Cinzano poster that had been left up from the pizza and jazz days.
Lily, when you looked at the Emperor's Ledger the other night, was Mike Sullivan's name in it?
Yeah, he was one of the last. But I thought that was just because his soul wasn't retrieved by one of you guys, like all the others.
Can you call him?
Of course I can't call him. He calls through magic or something. There's no number.
But I'm the only one who can hear him. That's what I'm saying, Asher. I have to stay at the crisis center. That's my special thing.
I've got to go call Audrey. I left my phone upstairs.
You massive wuss. Are you missing the fact that I am the only person who can speak to the dead, Asher?
Right. Just you and the Emperor, Charlie said. Be right back. He ran through the back room and up the stairs.
It's a big fucking deal,
she shouted after him, then settled into her well-practiced pout.
Fuck stick, she thought. Fuck stick, she called after him, knowing he wouldn't hear it, but saying it because it needed to be said.
Lily,
called a voice from the stairwell. Sophie ran, stumbled, hopped, tumbled down the stairs the way she did, then climbed up on the bar stool next to Lily.
I needs me my gin and juice, she said.
No gin, said Lily.
Just juice then, Sophie said.
Lily slid her Starbucks over to the kid, took a sip, made a face, then slid it back.
Where's Daddy? I mean Mike.
You just missed him.
More noise on the stairs, deliberate, heavy steps, lots of them, a tired horse descending. Sophie leaned over and whispered wetly,
I'm not supposed to call my dad Daddy in front of anyone because it would be weird.
Well, we wouldn't want it to be weird, Lily said.
Mrs. Korjev came out of the back room, eclipsing Mrs. Ling, who was right behind her, but identifiable by the squeak of the little cart she always rolled her groceries in, despite having to fold and unfold it to get it up and down stairs and up curbs and on and off buses or trains about 1,000 times every trip. Lily greeted each of the grandmothers, and they returned her greetings with the same distaste and distrust they had paid her since she was 16 and had first come to work for Charlie Asher.
Lily,
each of them had said in turn, slowly, as a greeting, just short of spitting in three languages after.
We take Sophie to buy vegetable, said Mrs. Korjev.
Maybe snack,
said Mrs. Ling, defiantly, for no apparent reason.
Both of you?
Lily asked. Mrs. Ling stormed forward in teeny-tiny steps, stopping twice to uncatch her cart from the edge of the bar, but stormed right up in Lily's face. Well, in Lily's general bosom area, but she was looking at her face.
You think we not know how to take care of Sophie? We take care of Sophie since baby. We know what good for her, not Mike. What is Manny? Said Mrs. Korjev. Is not real. Is imaginary. He is drug fiend. I see an Oprah.
Drug fiend,
said Mrs. Ling. Then she said something in Cantonese, most of which Lily didn't get except for white devil, which he learned a long time ago because it was how Mrs. Ling referred to anyone who wasn't Chinese.
Maybe you ladies should wait for Mike to come back.
He is drug fiend. I see an Oprah.
Drug fiend,
said Mrs. Ling. Then she said something in Cantonese, most of which Lily didn't get except for white devil, which he learned a long time ago because it was how Mrs. Ling referred to anyone who wasn't Chinese.
Maybe you ladies should wait for Mike to come back. He shouldn't be long.
We go, said Mrs. Ling. We go 4 blocks to market on Stockton Street, 4 block home, 2 hour tops. You tell, we go.
The two matrons herded Sophie through the back room and out the steel door into the alley, and Lily let them, because really, it was only 4 blocks, and it was the middle of the afternoon, so there was no danger from the Morrigan, and because she was a little afraid of both of them.
Bye, Lily,
Sophie called as the door closed behind them. Lily's phone buzzed. It was M. She contemplated sending it to voicemail for half a second, then remembered that he hadn't yet found out about her specialness.
Speak, she said.
Lily, where are you?
I'm at the
at Asher's.
You okay?
I'm mysterious.
Good. Look, Asher said he's sending his daughter out of town with his sister. I want you to see if you can go with them.
No. I have a job. I can't.
Damn it, Lily! Would you?
She could hear the exhale, his effort to calm his voice.
I need to know you're safe.
Chill, Em. I'm fine. It's broad daylight.
Doesn't matter. It's not the Morrigan. We're talking about a whole different level of badass. This motherfucker can go anywhere, any time of day. You hear me, girl? You need to get gone. Right now, and stay gone until this shit is over or everything is over. I need that from you.
She slid off the bar stool, ran around the bar, into the back room, and opened the steel door into the alley. No one was out there. Em, I'm gonna have to call you back.
Chapter 23 Strange Attractors. Audrey was missing her Charlies. Big Charlie, because he was her companion, her lover, her best friend, and Wiggly Charlie, because in the absence of Big Charlie, he was good for a laugh, better company than a dog, and a little more self-maintaining. Sort of like a talkative cat who wasn't a jerk, but could still be entertained by a piece of string. Charlie had been in his new apartment in his old building for only a day and a half, and she was already trying to think of ways to alter their living arrangement so they could be together, yet both attend to their responsibilities. Her first instinct was to have Charlie and Sophie move into the Buddhist Center. After all, she carried Sophie's mother's soul. The kid would get over the fact that she wasn't Jewish soon enough. But Charlie didn't think it would be fair to Jane and Cassie, who had really thrown themselves into raising Sophie as their own, plus the fact that Charlie, who inhabited Mike Sullivan's body, did not look like the Charlie the world knew as Sophie's father and who the world thought to be dead. The simplest solution, although not the easiest for Audrey, would be for her to leave her position at the Buddhist Center and move into Charlie's building with him and Sophie, which would make her what? Was her clinging to her title as the Venerable Amitabha Audrey Walker Rinpoche of the Three Jewels Buddhist Center a regression in consciousness? Was she clinging to a self that had no meaning? Was she, in fact, a hypocrite for not letting go of ego, of desire, of attachment, as she prescribed in her teaching? The bright side was that it might all be moot if the imbalance that seemed to be wobbling through the greater Bay Area destroyed the world of light as they knew it, and they would all be cast together into a dark pandemonium of destruction and disorder. So she had that going for her. She decided that she would call Charlie to celebrate their liberation into doom. But as she was scrolling through her contacts, looking for Mike Sullivan's phone number, one of the center's landlines rang. She pocketed her cell and picked up a handset in the kitchen. Mike Sullivan showed on the screen. "Hi, Charlie. I was just going to call you. You really need to change the name on your phone." "Audrey, the bridge. I think they're on the bridge." "You may have to be more specific, sweetie. Lily talked to Mike Sullivan, the dead one. His soul, or his ghost, whatever, is on the Golden Gate Bridge. He says there are thousands of other ghosts there." Audrey wasn't sure how to react. Wasn't sure she should really question Lily talking on a ghost phone, considering everyone's history. So, if that's true, that could be where all the missing souls went. Lily said Mike Sullivan's name was on the Emperor's list. What if all those souls, going back hundreds of years, are on the bridge? I suppose it makes as much sense as someone's soul trapped in an ashtray or a ceramic frog, and we've seen that. "Or a CD," Charlie said. His wife, Rachel's soul, had moved into a CD when she died shortly after Sophie was born, then moved out of it into Audrey. He'd seen it happen. "What do we do?" Audrey asked. "I don't know. That's why I called you." There was a skittering noise in the next room. Then the sound of something falling over, maybe a wastebasket. Wiggly Charlie, she thought. "Wait a second, Charlie. I heard something. Wiggly Charlie has been missing. It might be him. Hang on while I check." "Sure." As she came out of the kitchen, into the dining room, she saw one of the squirrel people on the other side of the room, and something grabbed her ankle. As she tried to steady herself, something caught her other ankle, and she fell forward, losing the handset as she went. "Audrey!" Charlie's voice over the phone. "No, I'm okay," she said. "Tripped. Just a second." Audrey twisted her head and saw one of the squirrel people with a duck's face and especially nimble paws pick up the handset and click it off. Then they were on her, all over her, the sound of duct tape ripping, tension around her ankles, tiny claws raking her, pulling her hands behind her back. Mrs. Korjeff led them up Stockton Street and into Chinatown, clearing the way through the crush of shoppers like a blocking back. Sophie right behind her, and Mrs. Ling bringing up the rear, the wheels on her cart squeaking like distressed mice.
At Jackson Street, Mrs. Korchev moved toward a luscious display of pears at the corner market, whose trays of fruit and vegetables ran along the sidewalk and around the corner for another quarter block on either side. Mrs. Ling went in low, did a quick hand sweep that threw a competing grandmother off balance, and snagged the perfect pear before her opponent could do anything about it. Doing Tai Chi every morning in Washington Square Park to Motown songs with 100 other oldsters might seem a waste of time at first glance, but when those slow, repetitive moves were cranked up to marketing intensity, only the grandma with the strongest kung fu would emerge with the perfect pear.
Eat dragon dung, Luther!
Mrs. Ling dropped the pear into her cart and moved on to some bok choy of superior crispness. Meanwhile, Mrs. Korjeff was quarrying carrots from a display, holding up one after another for Sophie's consideration.
No, said Sophie.
This one?
No, not big enough.
The market owner stood at his scale, watching the systematic destruction of his carefully arranged carrot display with muted alarm, one eye twitching slightly.
You want broccoli?
Asked Mrs. Korjeff.
Is there orange broccoli?
Sophie asked.
Green broccoli is good for you. Make you strong like bear.
But it's not vegan.
We put on cheese whiz. Make vegan for you.
Okay, broccoli, said Sophie.
Sophie moved behind Mrs. Korjeff, skipped around the corner, and yipped like a trot upon chihuahua.
Hey, Shad Dookie.
Instead of finding a new crowd of shoppers, Sophie stepped into a cleared space, a bubble of quiet, and in it stood the man in yellow.
That's not my name, said Sophie.
That's my name for you, said Lemon.
Eat shit and die, Sophie shouted.
Mrs. Korjeff came around the corner like a mother bear, spotted Lemon, put her hand on Sophie's shoulder.
Sophie, is not nice to say. What you say to gentlemen?
Please,
Sophie said, grinning at Lemon, unafraid.
Know something, Shy Dookie? You ain't the Big D no more. You ain't shit.
You better be careful, Sophie said.
Perplexed, Mrs. Korjeff started to pull Sophie away.
You are nasty man, she said to Lemon. She is little girl. She not know better. You should know better.
Yeah,
said Lemon. He held out his hand to Mrs. Korjeff, fingers spread, then closed it in front of her, like a starfish closing over a mollusk. Mrs. Korjeff gasped and collapsed on the spot. Sophie screamed, leaned on the fallen matron's shoulder, and screamed some more. The crowd closed around them, their cell phones beeping for 911. Sophie looked up to see the man in yellow strolling away. She made the same hand-closing gesture at him that he had just made to Mrs. Korjeff. He looked back and said,
You got nothing, Shy Dookie.
Despite the commotion and her own screaming, Sophie heard him as if his lips were pressed against her ear. Rivera loaded shotgun shells into a riot gun, one by one, at the counter of his store. The shades were pulled down, the sign turned to closed. He hadn't opened the store or even cleaned up since Cavuto had been killed here. There were still books, shredded by gunfire, and a bloodstain on the floor. He had collected two soul vessels on his calendar, easy finds, and they were tucked safely into the trunk of the brown, unmarked Ford parked out front. The plan was to pick up Baptiste and his soul vessels, then ride shotgun, literally, as they went to Minty Fresh's store, then carry Lang's place and picked up their inventory. They'd take them all to a vault storage facility that people use for storing fine art and furs in the Hayes Valley near City Hall. Ultimately, Baptiste would photograph each item, and his wife would post them to sell on the internet. They would retrieve them for shipping as they sold. Those details were not really worked out. The key was to get all the soul vessels they controlled out of the reach of the Morrigan and this mysterious man in the yellow Buick. Once the souls were secured, and Charlie Asher got his daughter out of town, they'd move on the Morrigan. Rivera pushed the last shell into the shotgun, then slipped on a knife-resistant vest that he had borrowed from the county jail, feeling a little silly. He had two bullet-resistant vests of his own, but they weren't going up against assailants with guns. His Beretta 9mm was in a shoulder holster, and the smaller Glock on his ankle. As he put on a sport coat, one he'd had tailored especially for hiding tactical gear, his phone buzzed. Baptiste.
"Are you ready?" Rivera said by way of greeting.
"Hello," said Baptiste. "Yes, I am ready, Inspector. I have all of the soul vessels, even the one stolen from the hospice the day you were there."
"You found it? How?"
"Well, that is why I am calling."
It is speaking French and walking around."
Rivera, armed and armored for battle, his plan arranged to the minute, and steeled by anger and the desire to avenge his friend, felt unprepared for this conversation.
"I don't think I follow," said Rivera. "It's, what, one of those talking dolls?" "In a manner of speaking, I think she is what Audrey referred to at the meeting as a square person. I can see her soul glowing in her chest. And it is Helen. She remembers me, but, well, she is knee-high and has the head of a cat.
And hands?" whispering in the background. "The hands of a raccoon."
"And you think it's your Helen?"
"That's what she says."
"Well, you can't sell her on the internet."
"No, that would be wrong. We are friends."
"How did you find her?"
"She came to me. When we were leaving the meeting at the Buddhist Center, she forced her way into my car."
"How did she force anything if she's not even knee-high?"
"She is very insistent."
"Audrey will know what to do. We'll take Helen back to the Buddhist Center after we leave Carrie Lang's pawn shop."
"She doesn't want to go there. She says they are all mad. She says we must help the cheese monster."
"The cheese monster?"
"Yes, that is what she says, I think. Her French is, she is working on her French. The monster who wants cheese, she says."
"Did you call Audrey?"
"No, I called you."
"Well, find a way to get Helen to the car. Put her in a box or something. Even with another stop, we should be able to get the souls in storage before dark. I'll call Audrey."
"Very well. But she heard what you said, and she says she will not get into a box."
"Do your best," said Rivera. "I'll be there in 20 minutes.
He disconnected, then called the Buddhist Center. Voicemail. He couldn't really have a uniform unit run by the Buddhist Center to check on her. He was pretty sure there wasn't even a radio code for cheese monster in distress. If they ran out of daylight, then the Helen creature could just stay with Baptiste, or Minty Fresh, or Charlie Asher. Just not him. He was not going to go into Mortal Kombat tomorrow worrying about a cat-headed lady talking in French about a cheese monster.
"You gave us life, but you gave us no voices!"
He waved his spork menacingly, only inches from her face. Audrey lay on the floor in the parlor, her feet and hands duct-taped, surrounded by squirrel people, many of whom she didn't recognize, except for the miniature hospital scrubs they wore. There were more than she had made, many more, over 100.
"What's the matter with you, Bob? If you needed supplies, all you had to do was ask."
"Ha!" said Bob. "Don't call me Bob. That is my slave name. I now remember my name from before, when I was a man. I am Thebe the Wise."
"Thebe! Thebe! Thebe!"
the people chanted.
"Hey, you guys can talk," Audrey said.
She felt she really should have been more frightened. But being menaced with a spork by a 14-inch megalomaniac in a beefeater's uniform seemed too absurd to be frightening, especially when she had collected and sewn his parts together herself. "What did you do?"
"We have collected our bodies from markets across the city, parts from Chinatown, from animals who died in the road, from trash bins. We have taken these unwanted parts, and we have made new people. We have stolen the souls from the death merchants, and with the Book of the Dead, we have given them voices."
"I didn't know how to do that when I made them," said Audrey. She really felt quite bad about it. She'd learned as she'd gone along. Bob and Wiggly Charlie had really been the finest examples of her craft, although there had been some mistakes along the way.
"You have trapped us in these horrible meat creatures, with no voices, with no genitals, except for him."
Two squirrel people, mostly lizard, pulled Wiggly Charlie through the crowd. His little arms were taped at his sides, his feet bound together, and his enormous willy dragged across the rug.
"Need a cheese," said Wiggly Charlie.
"Hi, WC, Audrey said. "I'm so sorry."
"What did you do to him?" asked Bob. "He seems, well, he's kind of goofy."
head injury, said Audrey.
Really? But his soul is gone.
He fell really hard. I really should make a helmet for him. I know I'll make helmets for you all.
No, you have done enough.
It's no bother, really, Audrey said. Helmets for everyone.
Helmets for everyone! Helmets for everyone! Helmets for everyone!
The little people chanted. Good crowd, Audrey said to Bob under her breath.
There will be no helmets, said Bob.
Various moans and murmurs of disappointment sounded around the room.
That's on you, buddy, said Audrey. Don't blame me if you take a tumble and end up like him.
Need a cheese,
said Wiggly Charlie.
No, you have made us miserable meat creatures, and now you shall be a miserable meat creature. Seize her! Take her to the Hall of Souls!
A score of squirrel people lifted Audrey, which was very uncomfortable, but she didn't struggle because most of them had sharp claws, and she'd already learned that the more she struggled, the more scratched up she got. They carried her through the parlor into the butler's pantry, where one of them kicked the wastebasket out of the way while the rest shoved her head into an uncovered vent, which was all that fit, just her head. Her shoulders caught on the side.
She won't fit, said a little voice. We can't take her in through outside. She won't fit through the hall of glass either, said another voice. New plan, said Thieb. New plan, new plan, new plan,
the people chanted. The Morgan waited, peering out of the storm sewer at the Buddhist Center until darkness fell. Then they flowed across the street like miscast shadows, their edges fringed with the ragged pattern of swarming birds. Bab saw a window cracked open just an inch on the second floor and so flowed up the wall and through the crack. Macha and Nemain flowed around either side of the downstairs walls, looking for an opening, then, finding none, slipped under the back porch, down the passageway made of auto glass, then up through the vent and into the butler's pantry. Not even remotely aware that they were passing just a few yards from the squirrel people's cache of soul vessels. In the parlor, Thieb the Wise stood between Audrey and Wiggly Charlie, who lay trussed up on the floor and finished reading the Pahawa of Forceful Projection to move Audrey's soul into WC's body. With a great flourish, Thieb finished the reading, enunciating the Sanskrit perfectly with his newly grown lips, then loomed over Wiggly Charlie.
Now you know the suffering that is our lot.
Need a cheese, said W.C.
He still doesn't have a soul, said the duck-faced guy.
No glow.
It didn't work, said Thieb.
He hopped to a spot in front of Audrey's face.
What happened?
The Pahawa of Forceful Projection moves the soul out of a soul vessel into a new body like yours. It won't work from a living human to a you guys.
Then from a dead human?
Said Thieb. Audrey said, that won't work either.
Guards! Thieb called.
Four squirrel people carrying weapons came forward through the crowd.
Thieb the Wise demands you stab her!
Said Thieb, and in doing so, he stepped away from Audrey and next to Wiggly Charlie to give his guards stabbing room.
No!
Shouted Wiggly Charlie and bit down on Thieb's leg, engaging a majority of his 78 needle-sharp teeth. Thieb squealed and tried to pull away, but instead ended up sawing his leg against W.C.'s teeth. The people all moved away from the calamity in the middle of the parlor, those with voices crying out in distress. A lizard-headed musketeer started to scamper up the big open staircase, only to be met by Babbed, who was oozing down the staircase, claws first. She caught the musketeer, tore him in half, and bit into the red light of his soul, her head and talons taking on dimension as she fed. Macha and Nemain slid out of the butler's pantry, Macha across the ceiling, Nemain across the floor.
Run! Audrey screamed. All of you, run!
Nemain impaled two of the people on her claws, and they screeched piteously as she bit into one's torso, and the other squirmed on her talon, the light of its soul dimming in an instant. Macha dropped from the ceiling like an inky blanket and fell upon a half dozen of the people, gathering them in a death embrace, crushing them. Bones cracked, splintered, four souls went dark. Macha stood full form in the middle of the parlor, holding one of the people in each hand, gore dripping down her face and chest. The people scattered, running for every exit, through the dining room, crowding the vent in the butler's pantry, some scrambling up the stairs, a few skittering through the foyer and trying to get to the front doorknob. Thebe struggled to free himself from Wiggly Charlie's jaws. Nemain stepped by Wiggly Charlie, and Thebe stuck her in the ankle with his spork.
Fuck! Ouch!
She kicked Thebe, who was ripped out of WC's mouth, and went flying into the butler's pantry. Wiggly Charlie went spinning across the floor the other way. One of the guards, an iguana-headed fellow, in green scrubs, brandishing a screwdriver, charged her, and the main impaled him in the chest on a single claw and lifted him to her eye level. She turned him in the air, as if she was examining a particularly fascinating hors d'oeuvre. She looked down at Audrey.
Did you make these? They're delicious!
Nemain closed her eyes and tilted her head back in ecstasy as the light pumped out of the guard's soul, absorbed through her claw as if she was filling a syringe. Across the room, Macha slung the lifeless body of a squirrel ballerina against the wall, then reached for Wiggly Charlie, saw there was no soul light in him, and tossed him aside. She dropped to all fours and crawled up to Audrey until their faces were nearly touching. Audrey squirmed to move away, wiggled a few feet back before encountering a chair leg, her breath coming in little yips as if each breath had to resist turning into a scream.
Macha said, I don't know whether to take your head or just open your veins and watch your life drain out on the floor. Oh, you have to take her head, said Nemain, now standing over them both. I vault head, said Babd,
moving up behind Nemain, blood dripping from her talons.
There you have it, said Macha.
She scissored her claws in front of Audrey's face.
Hurry, said Nemain. All the souls are getting away.
Macha snarled, reared back. Audrey screamed, tried to tuck her face into her knees.
That will be enough, ladies,
came a voice from the foyer. They stopped. Lemon filled the parlor doorway.
Go get you some critters, ladies. I'ma have me a chat with the venerable Rinpoche. Audrey.
Chapter 24. Battle. It was 7 p.m. and Charlie Asher had been at St. Francis Hospital for 2 hours. With no word of how Mrs. Korjeff was doing, if the soul vessels had been safely moved, or what was going on with Audrey. He had called everyone, and no one had picked up. He suspected either they didn't remember he was using Mike Sullivan's phone, or someone was fucking with him. Strangely enough, despite having jettisoned the body that carried his original beta male DNA, he still had the personality of a beta and its built-in, double-edged imagination, which, in addition to helping him anticipate and avoid danger, engendered a suspicion that someone, usually someone unknown and cleverly wicked, was fucking with him. Possibly, and even probably in this case, the mobile phone people. Fortunately, the hospital cafeteria had macaroni and cheese, so he was able to feed Sophie, their other vegan selection being wood and leaves with suffering. Now she was in the waiting room, sleeping next to Lily in one of the vinyl-padded chairs designed so you wouldn't sleep in them. She'd refused to go home with only Lily, but if he could reach Jane and Cassie, maybe he could get her out of here without waking her. Finally, a text buzzed into his phone from Jane. We are on our way. He walked over and slumped in the chair next to Lily. Something like this happens, he said. You realize you don't really even know the people you know. She's lived in my building for 10 years. She's helped me with Sophie since she was a baby. There are things I should have told her. There were things I wanted to ask her. Lily nodded knowingly.
Like why she never had that thing taken off her lip?
No, important things. Things so she'd know that she was important to me, to my family. Now,
you couldn't have known.
I did know, said Charlie, and so did you, which is why you should have stopped them from going out.
This is my fault?
No, but I'd prefer it if it were.
Fine, it's on me.
You should never pass up an opportunity to be kind. You should never not thank someone. You should never not say something nice when you think it.
I don't.
Okay, then.
You done?
I suppose so. He slumped down farther in the chair. You hear from Minty?
Not yet, but...
She nodded through the double glass door, which Minty Fresh was approaching. Tell him I was badass.
You were afraid to confront two old ladies.
Okay, tell him I was helpful.
She had been helpful, in a way. In that she had broken into Mrs. Korjev's apartment and found her matron's address book, so Charlie could call her sons, one who lived in Seattle, the other in Los Angeles.
Minty Fresh wore a black leather car coat with his usual ensemble of shades of green, but Rivera was wearing an ill-fitting tweed sport coat. Charlie stood to meet them.
The old lady okay?
Said Minty Fresh. We don't know. It was her heart, said Charlie.
But she's hanging on?
So far, they won't really talk to us, me, since I barely know her, officially. Maybe when Jane gets here.
Oh, right. You know that Chinese lady from your building is out on the front stoop? What's she doing out there?
Pacing. They won't let her bring her cart in, and she won't leave it.
Well, leave it in your car.
We came in a cab, followed the ambulance. Minty Fresh shrugged. Rivera said,
I can have a uniform unit take her home.
She won't go, said Charlie. Minty looked to Lily.
Why are you still here?
Lily tilted her head toward the sleeping Sophie, saying more or less because of the kid.
I'm not going to leave town, Em, even if Jane and Cassie go. I have work tomorrow. I'm going to be on those lines if Mike calls in from the bridge.
Minty Fresh tapped out three beats with his size 16s, a habit he'd acquired from arguing with Lily over the last year.
Well, at least go to your mother's place. Stay there tonight. There's no way Lemon will know to look for you there, even if he's been watching you.
Whoa, said Charlie. Lemon? This man in yellow that Sophie has been talking about is called Lemon? Minty Fresh glanced around the waiting room, as if there might be some obvious explanation written on one of the pieces of innocuous motel art.
Well, yeah, that's sort of a shorthand I made up, you know.
To Lily, he said,
anyway, will you at least stay at your mother's house and take a cab to work, please?
Looking at Rivera, Charlie said, would you guys run by the Buddhist Center and check on Audrey? I was on the phone when all this happened. We got disconnected, and I haven't been able to get a hold of her.
We will, said Rivera.
Charlie held out a key. This is for the front door. Minty Fresh took it and turned on a heel.
We'll call you in 10 minutes.
Thanks, Charlie said, and watched them go. He sat on the other side of Sophie and stroked her hair as she slept.
He loves you, you know, he said to Lily.
Not going to discuss this with you.
Okay.
They passed the next few minutes by not talking and not looking at people who were trying not to look at them, except for those who looked at Sophie, sleeping, and smiled. Charlie leafed through some magazines to distract himself, only to find that he was made more anxious by wondering what kind of sociopathic fuckweasel would do all the puzzles and highlights in pen. These monsters walk among us? He thought. His phone buzzed.
She's fine, said Rivera.
How is she fine? Why didn't she call?
She said she dropped her phone and it broke and she didn't have your new number written down anywhere. She left a message on your sister's landline. She's in the car with us. You want to talk to her?
Yes, well, yes.
Hi, Charlie, Audrey said. Sorry, there was a little bit of a meltdown with the squirrel people. Anyway, the inspector and Mr. Fresh are going to take me to your place, if that's okay.
Sure. He looked at Lily, mouthed, she's okay.
Of course that's okay, but I'll be here a while. Mrs. Korjev's son is flying up from Los Angeles.
We still haven't heard on her condition other than she's still critical.
I hope she'll be okay. I have WC with me. He's, well, the squirrel people were mean to him.
Okay, I think there's some mozzarella sticks in the fridge. I'll be home as soon as I can. I was really hoping we could spend tonight together, since, you know, we may not get any more after tomorrow.
How could you say that? Don't say that. You guys,